Welcome to the courtroom. We have a second case this morning, 11 AP 1030 CR, State versus Gerald D. Taylor. Arguing for the defendant, Mr. Taylor, is Assistant State Public Defender Andrew R. Henkel. Mr. Henkel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. And may it please the court, when Mr. Taylor entered his plea, the court told him that he was exposing himself to any sentence up to 6 years. Now, in reality, he was exposing himself to any sentence up to 8 years. This 0 to 8 range is the range on which the court actually sentenced Mr. Taylor. And the question before this court today is whether Mr. Taylor had the right to know that range at the time that he entered his plea. And the answer to that question is the same whether we look to the federal and state constitutions, whether we look to Wisconsin Statute 97108, or whether we look to this court's precedents. And the answer is yes. Knowledge of the potential consequences of a guilty plea is a basic right of a pleading defendant. Mr. Taylor's plea was not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent on the day that he entered it, and nothing that happened afterward can change that fact. He must be allowed to withdraw it, as I've argued in the briefs, and as I'll argue today. I'd also like to talk a little bit today, a little more broadly, about what a contrary result holding Mr. Taylor to his non-knowing plea would mean for the criminal justice system in this state. In this state, we protect knowing, voluntary, and intelligent pleas by a system that this court established in State versus Bangert in 1986. The system's been working well for 26 years. It reaches constitutional results in plea withdrawal cases. But it also encourages good pleas and good colloquies in the first instance so that in most cases no withdrawal is necessary, no withdrawal is desired, and no withdrawal is allowed. I'm going to argue today that the exception that the state would carve out of Bangert, or really any departure from the rule that a defendant must know the maximum sentence at the time that they enter the plea, would allow unconstitutional pleas. It would encourage inadequate colloquies, and as a result, it would generate additional post-conviction litigation.
Besides that, will the sky fall?
No, I think we can count on the sky to stay where it is.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't want to be held to that. Now, turning first to this case, the United States Supreme Court said in 1969 and 1970 in Boykin and Brady that knowledge of the punishment to which a defendant is exposing him or herself is a component of due process. It's a component of a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent plea. State has suggested that maybe a defendant doesn't have to know precisely what that maximum is, but I guess I can't make any other sensible meaning of what Boykin said, which is that a defendant has to have a full understanding of what the plea connotes and of its consequence, or of what Brady said when it said that a defendant has to be fully aware of the direct consequences. The state has suggested that perhaps Mr. Taylor knew the punishments as, a practical matter, but I don't see how knowing that you could be sentenced to 6 years is the same as knowing that you could be sentenced to 8 years as a practical matter. The state has also suggested that it's not necessarily the law that a defendant needs to know the exact maximum. But as far as I can tell, knowing the maximum means the same thing as knowing the exact maximum. When we use the number 6 or the number 8 in the statutes or in a judicial decision or the word maximum in a judicial decision, it means exact. The statutes don't say that the penalty for a Class H felony is exactly 6 years. It says 6 years, and we all understand that that means exactly six.
Counselor, you're supposed to persuade us that it would be a manifest injustice not to let him withdraw his plea. And so he has pled to a crime and been sentenced for a crime within the range he was told rather than within the actual range. Why would that be a manifest injustice today?
Well, for, I guess, three reasons. First, under the system that Bangert imposes, failure to understand required information, a failure of the colloquy combined with an assertion that you failed to understand the requisite information, combined with the state's failure to prove to the contrary at the hearing, equals manifest injustice. I mean, I think it's quite clear in Bangert that a defendant who makes that prima facie case and doesn't have it rebutted has shown manifest injustice as it's understood in Bangert. But more importantly, I think, Mr. Taylor wasn't told that he would receive a six-year sentence, of course, when he pled. He was told a range of 0 to 6 years. Now, Mr. Taylor, and that's all the information that we generally give to defendants in this state. We don't tell them. There are no binding plea recommendations, unlike in some other jurisdictions. So Mr. Taylor knew that he could receive a sentence somewhere in that range, and he had reason to imagine that he might receive something less than a maximum sentence. And in fact, he did receive something less than the actual maximum sentence when the court sentenced him. So I don't think without having a knowledge of the true range of the penalty, Mr. Taylor was not capable of making an intelligent decision about whether to plead in the first place. And I think that that's a clear manifest injustice when we when we allow a defendant to enter a plea based on a misunderstanding of what he's doing.
I'm not sure that I understand the certification memo. Certification memo to us says that there seems to be a conflict problem harmonizing, is it Cross and Brown? So I'm not so sure what this Court of Appeals was driving, and we took it. So somehow we must have been persuaded at the time that there's a problem. Now we have at least two cases that talk about that the trial court did not give the correct statement of the penalty, right? And that's it. This is a, you didn't tell him the right penalty, the correct penalty. Sometimes the trial court gives him a higher penalty in the plea colloquy. Sometimes the trial court gives him a lesser penalty, right?
Correct.
And there's always in these cases a withdrawal of the plea after sentencing, right?
Correct.
So it gets into manifest injustice.
Correct.
One way of showing manifest injustice is didn't knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently enter the plea, right?
Yes.
And that's what your client is saying. And what your client wants is what? A evidentiary hearing, right?
Well, that's what he wanted at the time that we filed the motion.
Correct.
And we showed up in court for that evidentiary hearing, and the state had its opportunity to put on evidence and didn't put any on.
Right, and didn't put any on. And you say under, this is a Bangert violation right on the face of it, right?
Correct.
And therefore you're entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Now, the court goes off not on evidentiary hearing, but it goes says, hey, even if you didn't know, you didn't voluntarily, intelligently, and knowingly enter your plea, doesn't matter. It's harmless error because the plea would have been entered anyway, as best we can guess, right?
Correct.
So what's the matter with this? What's the matter with the way that case is being held, has been handled? And in, what was it, Cross, I think it was, the court said only if it's a substantial error or deviation from the statute. So is the 2 years less a substantial deviation? If it's not a substantial deviation, it's not even error. As I understand that case. So tell me what's the issue here? What's the problem here? And Mr. Balistrary says, hey, none of that's applicable. Let's look at Reppin, right?
Correct.
Okay, so what's the problem? What is the certification? What is the conflict between Cross and Brown, if there is one? And what about Reppin?
All right. What the Court of Appeals was saying was that in Cross, while this court established the not substantially higher standard when for instances in which a defendant is misinformed over the true maximum, it also...
The less maximum. Go ahead.
Correct. It also very clearly cabined that result into pleas that involve over information, telling a too high a maximum. And it said... that in the contrary case, like Mr. Taylor's case, the defendant's due process rights are at greater risk. So that's one authority. And the other authority...
Have a sentence that has nothing to do with that particular case that raises this issue. Okay, go ahead.
Right. Well, and then Brown, of course, says right at the end of the opinion, apparently the defendant in Brown had made an allegation that he hadn't been told, or probably hadn't been told, that the two sentences that he was subjecting himself to could be run consecutively. Although he didn't allege that he didn't understand that fact, he didn't make that Bangert prima facie case, and this court rejected the defendant's claim, and one of the things that the court said was, well, in this case, it would be harmless since he didn't receive even the maximum of one of the sentences. So I think the conflict that the Court of Appeals perceives is that we have a case in Brown that is, I suppose, like Mr. Taylor's case, where it involves arguably under-information as to the potential sentence. And this court said harmless error, whereas in Cross, it said that that was likely to be a due process violation.
Mr. Henkel, can I ask you a quick question? The underlying charge is 6 years as a max, but because of the prior convictions, which were misdemeanors, it would be an additional possible 2 years, right?
That's correct.
When I read through the plea transcript, and maybe I just missed it, but I don't see the judge going through the prior misdemeanor convictions at all with him. Are we just supposed to accept the fact that he could rely on the complaint, even though this was a no contest? Or do you think the judge had a duty to go through the prior misdemeanor convictions and say, in case 04CM129, do you agree that you're convicted of disorderly conduct? In 05CM1294, do you agree you were convicted of do you think that, as a trial court judge, I typically had them actually acknowledge which cases they were agreeing were the prior convictions before I'd impose a penalty enhancer.
Right.
Here, the judge didn't do that, right? The maximum is 6 years.
Well, it is a common practice for the court to somehow prove up or have the repeater proved up at the plea hearing, but it's not legally required. The law in this state is that as long as the defendant admits the repeater either at the plea hearing or at the sentencing, then
Wait,
the repeater
can you direct me in the record to where he admitted the repeater?
Yes, I can.
So you don't quarrel at all with the judge not going through any priors and getting specific convictions? Because I could see your argument
that's not
being
our, that's
the
not
opposite,
our position.
Really.
I think it's quite clear that that Mr. Taylor was convicted as a repeater.
See, the court says there's a sufficient factual basis. I do find you guilty. Oh, strike that. You know what? I see it now. It's at the very end.
Towards
he
end.
Did it at the end, although I didn't see it during the questioning of him. But he just kind of did it without asking him if he could use those priors.
Right. And I believe he also asked if he could rely on the complaint, which does, in fact, contain those allegations.
Okay. So you're saying that's just fine. He doesn't need to really say which ones or acknowledge.
I believe Mr. Taylor was correctly convicted as a repeater.
Okay.
Except to the extent that his plea was involuntary.
General rule is you can look at the whole record for knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, right?
That's correct.
And here, when you look at the whole record, in the complaint, he was advised that there was an 8-year sentence potential, wasn't he?
That's, well, after a fashion, yes.
At least he saw the complaint, could have seen the complaint.
Well, I'm quibbling because the statutory language is what's included in the complaint, and it's I understand it being a trained criminal lawyer, and I'm sure that this court understands it. Whether Mr. Taylor would understand that 8 years was what he was getting out of that paragraph, I'm not sure.
Okay. But there was also a plea questionnaire.
That's correct.
Which he signed.
That's correct. Right,
with counsel.
Yes.
And that plea questionnaire indicated 8 years.
Yes.
So looking at the whole record, why can't we say your client knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily understood it was 8 years. Therefore, he doesn't fall under manifest injustice.
Well, For a couple of reasons. First of all, I mean, there remains the fact that the trial judge at the time that he entered his plea told him 6 years. I mean, it's possible that Mr. Taylor just disregarded what his counsel had said at this point, at that point, and listened to what the trial judge said. It's also possible that he disregarded what the trial judge said and figured his counsel had it right. But we don't know that, and it's really a question of fact. And no findings of fact were made at the trial court level. So I think to make that finding at this stage is not really, you know, what this court typically does.
Well, I thought you were going to answer, maybe I'm wrong on the law, that the cases say, look, the statute says this is what you got to tell the defendant, you trial judge. Bangert says this is what you got to tell him. And that you can't substitute the complaint for that, and you cannot substitute the questionnaire for that.
That's also true. There is a case saying that, and I can't call up the name right now.
And therefore, hey, if you keep doing that, then the statute is undermined, and Bangert is undermined, because Bangert was a clear rule.
I think that's true in your example. If the appellate courts simply say, well, looking at the whole record, we think it was probably okay, that's one problem. Another problem is, if the appellate courts are, you know, approving sort of these post hoc justifications for why, even though a person didn't know the required information at the time of the plea, well, it's okay. It's okay because the 1967 commentary to the ABA rules says, well, it's okay. I don't think that that's going to be an efficient way of enforcing the court's plea colloquy responsibilities, which is a stated aim of Bangert, and it's been reiterated and reiterated by this court ever since, most recently and I think forcefully in State versus Brown.
I see this case as calling upon us to determine whether or not harmless error can be applied here. Without giving an evidentiary Bangert hearing. That's what happened here. I mean, you state the issue is whether or not the plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary under these circumstances. And your motion points to a particular part of the colloquy that was inadequate, and it asserts that your client didn't know.
Correct.
Now, our jurisprudence, there's an argument about this, but our jurisprudence heretofore has suggested that in colloquy deficiency cases, if a defendant can point to a specific provision that's required under the law and a specific inadequacy as a result in the plea colloquy and makes the second prong assertion, then I think, as was written in Brown, when a Bangert motion is filed, it is reviewed by the court. If the motion establishes a prima facie violation of WSSTAT 971 or 8 or other court-mandated duties, and makes the requisite allegation, the court must hold a post-conviction evidentiary hearing at which the state is given an opportunity to show by clear, convincing evidence, satisfactory, and so the burden shifts, as we both know, and you can look in the entire record here. So I could see that as the real issue. It seems like that's what the Court of Appeals and their certification talked about. Is harmless error going to be applied here? And there's some reference and some opinions to harmless error or manifest injustice. Is that the street or is that the road this court is going down now? Or are we staying with if you make that as to a point to the deficiency of a colloquy with regard to a mandated procedure of information, and you make the other requisite allegation that you must, as Brown says, have an evidentiary Bangert hearing? Or can we just say harmless error and not give one?
Well, I don't think that this court should say harmless error.
Is that the issue? I mean, maybe I'm seeing it wrong. I mean, is that the issue? Court, that's what the certification's about.
Well, and that's what the assistant district attorney said in the circuit court, and that's what the state said in the court of appeals. So it's not too surprising that harmless error is the hook about which the court of appeals is talking.
And does that, just to add to that, does it matter whether the judge gave the defendant stated a too high penalty or too low? Because where there was substantial higher is cross, right?
Correct.
And cross said, oh, if it was lower, then you have a different kind of case. I mean, so is there a difference?
You may have.
Right.
May have. I guess first to answer Justice Bradley's question, I don't think that harmless error as a concept really applies to this situation or to Bangert cases generally, at least as it's been enunciated by the state and by the Court of Appeals. The harm in a Bangert case is that the defendant didn't know something that he ought to have known at the time that he pled.
What about the language in Brown? I quoted some of the language in Brown that says you must have an evidentiary hearing if you meet the pointed allegations with regard to the colloquy. But there's also reference towards the end of that opinion to harmless error. So
yes, there is. There's.
How do you get away from that or explain that or
deal
with it?
I agree with the state that the situation in Brown was not doctrinally correctly harmless error. I think that the result was correct. It's obvious that the result was correct because the defendant didn't allege a prima facie case. But I think that that paragraph of Brown, that sentence of Brown, is worth revisiting. I think that it certainly injected some uncertainty into the law, as the Court of Appeals certification suggests. And to turn to Chief Justice Abrahamson's question, which I have now forgotten.
Is there a different rule if the trial judge mistakenly says a higher penalty or if she mistakenly says a lower penalty?
I think there are a lot of very important differences between the cross situation and I guess what we'll call the Taylor situation. First of all, as Cross noted, I mean, first of all, Cross makes the distinction on its own. And the reason that it does that is because it notes the constitutional difficulty, the due process difficulty of not telling someone the full range of punishment to which they're exposing themselves. And I think that's simply true as a matter of arithmetic, that the defendant in Cross, I think, was told 40 years or something like that, and it turned out to be 30.
35.
35, thank you. And in that case, it's just a mathematical fact that if you're told that you could serve 40 years in prison, you're also aware that you could serve 35 years. You have been told the full range. You've been told a little extra, but you've been told the range. In a case like Mr. Taylor's, eight does not fall within the range of 0 to 6. He wasn't told about 2 years of his life that he could be spending in prison.
Well, what's the big deal? I mean, if you had this evidentiary hearing, this Bangert hearing, based on your motion and allegations, isn't the first thing the state going to do is show you the plea advisement and waiver of rights form, and take a look at the complaint and look at the initial appearance and acknowledge receipt of the complaint and blah, you know, read it, and the judge is going to say, well, I look to the record in its entirety, which is our law, and I deny your motion. I find that the plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntarily made. I mean, isn't that what's going to happen, and why should we be going through those hoops?
Well, again, I mean, I don't know what Judge Dyer, whoever would hear the case in Appleton, would do, but I think certainly the point of Bangert is that when we have a prima facie case made, and that's what has to happen. And, you know, it may be that the state is able to show that Mr. Taylor, in fact, understood the time to which he was subjecting himself by pleading. But, again, that's a factual finding, and it's part of the enforcement mechanism of Bangert. Those post-conviction motion hearings aren't a defect of Bangert. They're not sort of an unfortunate waste of everybody's time. They're the principal enforcement mechanism that this court has established to make sure that courts are scrupulous in taking guilty pleas in the first place.
you explain the application of harmless error under these facts?
I don't believe that harmless error really applies to these facts. As I argued a little bit in my brief, it's the traditional conception of harmless error is an error that doesn't affect the result of the proceedings. And the United States Supreme Court, among others, has reasoned that if, you know, the result of the pleadings here is the conviction that's entered on the guilty plea. And so the question becomes, would the defendant have pled even if they had known the correct information? That is, if the error had never been committed, would the result be the same? I don't think, and of course, the burden is on the state, the beneficiary, to show a harmless error. I don't think it's obvious, actually, that the state hasn't shown that. They haven't put forth any information. But I'd also say that since I've been preparing for this oral argument, I'm no longer entirely convinced that a due process lack of knowing voluntary intelligent plea can be remedied in that way. I say that because there's a footnote that I noticed in the case of U.S. versus Dominguez Benitez, which is one of the cases I cited in my brief, and that case says it explicitly cordons off the technical Rule 11 violation that the Supreme Court is talking about and says, we caution that we're not saying the same thing about due process claims, about claims that pleas are not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And it essentially says, no, even overwhelming evidence that the defendant would have pled the same way won't remedy, we're not saying that it would remedy a plea that was not knowing, excuse me, voluntary and intelligent.
There is a reference to harmless error in Wisconsin Statute 805.18, which I think is a little bit different context for harmless error. Are you familiar with that statute?
I can't recall the wording offhand.
Wisconsin Statute 805.18, entitled Mistakes and Omissions, Harmless Error. And the court shall, in every stage of an action, disregard any error or defect in the pleadings or proceedings which shall not affect the substantial rights of the adverse party. It's a little bit different, a little bit different context than
I agree that it's a different wording, although, of course, the wording of that statute can't change the constitutional rules or the constitutional remedy or the constitutional idea of harmless error that is imposed by the federal constitution. And I'd also point out that, at least in my view, the substantial rights of the defendant include knowing what they're pleading to and knowing what the potential consequences are at the time that they plead. And nothing that has happened since Mr. Taylor's plea can change the fact that he didn't.
Could I ask, when these Bangert motions are made, are they usually accompanied by an affidavit from the defendant, or is it always an allegation made by counsel?
It's generally an allegation by counsel. I can't say that no one has ever submitted an affidavit, but I believe that there is, I can't recall the name, but there have been appellate decisions saying that no affidavit is necessary. Now, of course, an attorney can't make that allegation if they can't stand behind it, don't know it to be true.
Well, as we have discussed here, the plea colloquy occurred on, I think it's the 23rd of August, and the plea questionnaire is exactly the same day. And there have been so many documents, and I suspect hearings as well, in which different information about the maximum sentence was supplied to the defendant. This was a defendant also who's been around the track a while, a couple of times.
It's true, although I believe this was his first conviction as a repeater.
I mean, it's a little hard for me to believe that he actually didn't know what was going on here.
Well, again, I mean, I think I've already made my argument about why Bangert requires a hearing, but I guess, suggest to the court that the fact that your defense counsel goes over this plea questionnaire with you and tells you it's 8 years doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to believe the trial judge when he tells you that it's 6 years.
When did they file the motion for post-conviction relief?
I don't recall what date I filed it.
Was it before or after the sentencing?
Oh, it's post-sentencing.
Long.
And when did you get the pre-sentence investigation report to review?
When did I get it? I mean, I wasn't the trial attorney, so I got it.
Defense get it.
I'm not sure, but I'm sure it was before sentencing.
Okay. And reviewed that with the client. And in that, did it reference, do you know if the PSI referenced the maximums?
I'm not certain. I would imagine so.
Any idea why the motion wouldn't have been brought when they read the PSI also and say, gee, you know, it's really 8 years I face here?
Well, you know, I don't know what Mr. Taylor understood at any of those times. I really don't know. I see that my time has expired. Unless the court has further questions, I'll stand down for Mr. Balistrieri.
We have 5 minutes, and I don't see or hear any move towards further questions. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Thomas Balistrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Balistrieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first address the question that Justice Bradley asked about the need for an evidentiary hearing. While it is true that the Bangert jurisprudence says that you get an evidentiary hearing if you make these allegations, blah, 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 we know that there is also general case law relating to the need for an evidentiary hearing, which states that you don't get an evidentiary hearing if the record conclusively shows that you're not entitled to relief. And that's the situation here. The record conclusively shows that Mr. Taylor is not entitled to relief on his claim that he should be permitted to withdraw his guilty plea, because the record conclusively shows that his plea was entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, despite the judge's misstatement at the Banger hearing that the maximum plea was 6 years instead of eight.
So you want, rather than as Bangert contemplates, that the trial court would be the finder of fact, you want to, since it's a bifurcated standard, you know, historical fact and constitutional fact, but you want us to determine, based on the facts of this case, without hearing what he has to say, that
there's no need to hear what he has to say. That's my point. There's no need to hear what he has to say because the record, as it presently exists, with what was said by the defendant, what was said by the judge, and what the judge, most importantly, what the judge said and did at the sentencing, the record conclusively shows that this plea was entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, did not violate due process. There's no constitutional violation. There's no statutory violation. This is a perfectly good plea on the record we have now.
One of the things that I learned as a circuit court judge is that even though all of the facts are stacked up and there is just absolutely no doubt in my mind that X happened, no doubt whatsoever, why waste my time? And then people get on the stand and X didn't happen. And so even though when things seem so obvious, if they're questions of fact.
There are no questions of fact here. We have a record that was made by the court. There's no question of fact. At the plea hearing, the judge said 6 years. Mm-hmm. At the sentencing, the judge said 6 years. There's no facts to be determined.
But
those are facts
because,
on the record.
That's because it anticipates.
So what are we going to?
The defendant comes. I don't know. But things are crazy, right? Sometimes life is a little bit imperfect. So the defendant comes at a Bangert hearing and says, here, look, I've got this prescription drug. I took the prescription drug. I wasn't tuned in at all that morning, and maybe even can have some evidence that would suggest that. I mean, you don't know what's going to come up.
Those aren't the allegations.
Well, the allegation is that the plea wasn't knowing, intelligently, and voluntarily.
Only
because they didn't know this. And you're saying the record shows that he knows this. And that's why we have an evidentiary hearing to have to see if he really knew it.
What would we show at an evidentiary hearing? What would we show? We would show, hypothetically, the judge told him 6 years. He says, I thought it was 6 years. I didn't know it was 8 years. The judge gave him a 6-year sentence. How is that any different than the record?
Well, on cross-examination, the state would say, that's what you say, but you also sign this questionnaire. It says 8 years. That questionnaire says you talked all of this over with your counsel. So did you talk to your counsel? Yes. Did he tell you 8 years? I don't remember. Or no. Did you read this questionnaire like you said you did? And did you see that 8 years is on it? I don't know what his answer is going to be. And defense counsel, because this is a also ineffective assistance of counsel issue, right?
That's a possibility, yeah.
Right. Might put defense counsel on and say, did you tell him, et cetera. So then the judge says, I believe defense counsel. I don't believe you didn't know it when I have all this plea questionnaire, et cetera. So I'm not letting you open this up. How long do you think that hearing's going to take?
2 minutes.
Exactly. So the question is, how long do you think it's taken to go through the Court of Appeals and hit this court now? More than 2 minutes. You got to clean this up right away. And that's the way you can do this. But the question, I think, is you keep saying, this record shows he knew. So tell me, when I go through the record, and there are cases that say that the appellate court can look through the entire record and make a determination of knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, right?
Right.
Okay. So when I go through the record, what in the record is going to tell me it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary? The end.
What is going to tell you that is that he got the very sentence that he was told and knew he could get. He was told he could get a sentence of 6 years. He took the risk when he entered his plea that he could get the sentence of 6 years. He got the sentence of 6 years that he was told.
That's harmless error.
And
that's a harmless error argument.
It's not a harmless error.
It wouldn't have affected his plea because he got what he thought he might get.
Well,
harmless error dressed up in manifest injustice.
Exactly.
Now, there is a difference between manifest injustice and harmless error.
You need to dress it up.
Okay, go ahead. Why isn't that a harmless error argument?
Because under our harmless error standard, as this court has articulated it, and although you, most recent cases that I'm aware of, you haven't really settled on one specific view of harmless error, but the
get
views...
That. Don't get into that, Meyer.
I know. That's what I don't want to do. That's exactly what I don't want to do. I don't want to get into that mess.
Right.
But
whatever the harmless
error
is.
Whatever harmless error is, it deals with the result of the proceeding, whether the result of the proceeding would have been the same.
Right.
And I can't say that he would have pleaded... I mean, I'm making the assumption here that he didn't know he could get 8 years.
Okay.
I can't say on this record that he would have pleaded guilty even if he had known it was 8 years.
Your position here is that he was told six, he got six or less, no big deal.
That's it.
Okay, suppose he had gotten seven.
If he would have gotten seven, he would have been permitted to he would be permitted to withdraw his plea. Or, as some cases from other jurisdictions have said, he would have had an option of taking the 6-year maximum. But there would have been a clear Bangert violation.
But he knew because it was on the plea agreement.
But that's different. That would have required an evidentiary hearing and a finding of fact by the judge. It's not automatic.
Would have required an evidentiary hearing.
Right.
And then if it showed that he didn't knowingly and voluntarily do it, then there would be two, potentially two remedies.
Right.
Withdraw or take the six,
yeah,
in your opinion.
Yeah, that's what some cases from other jurisdictions say the remedy is. But it's pretty clear that if he doesn't get the sentence, well, I should put it this way, if he gets a sentence that is more than he is told he could get, there is a clear violation. His plea is not knowing, voluntary, and intelligent, and he can withdraw it.
Well, the statute,
it's got to be the sentence he was told he could get or less.
Okay. Now, I have a question. What has Reppin got to do with all this? I mean, I didn't see Reppin. Maybe I missed it in the certification or in the discussion. So I read Reppin. You base this on Reppin.
I do.
All right. Tell me more, please.
Well, I think the problem is, as Mr. Hinkle points out in his brief, that Reppin has kind of been forgotten.
All right.
Not been overruled. It's still good law.
1967 case.
You bet.
Right. Good year.
For some of us. All for right. some of us.
It also it adopted the ABA standard. So what? Tell me what Reppin says, in your opinion, and why that's still good law, right?
Yeah, Reppin says that, and in one of the situations that it posits as a situation where there may be a manifest injustice, and those situations were adopted by this court when it adopted the manifest injustice test. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the law of Wisconsin. One of those situations is that the defendant did not know that the sentence actually imposed could be imposed. That is one of the situations in which there can be a manifest injustice. Now, the obvious corollary to that, which isn't included in the standards but is included in the commentary to that, is if the defendant does get, if the sentence that is actually imposed is a sentence that the defendant was told and knows he could get, then there is no manifest injustice because he knew he could get the sentence and he took the risk that he could get that sentence when he entered his plea. Now, has the Reppin standard hasn't been articulated a lot in recent cases, but it's never been overruled. It was certainly not overruled by Bangert. Bangert changed procedure. It did not change anything of substance.
Well, let's take a look at that. The procedure, according to the Court of Appeals, and I am reading from the certification on page 3, the burden-shifting procedure for deficient plea colloquies is an exception to the general rule wherein a defendant bears the burden of both alleging sufficient facts to warrant a hearing and then establishing a manifest injustice by clear, convincing evidence in order to withdraw a plea. So the Court of Appeals sees Bangert as an exception to the Reppin case, which employed...
Well, I don't think it's an exception. I think it changed Reppin.
Well, let's take
a look.
It
wasn't an exception. It made a change.
Let's take a look.
It shifted the burden.
With regard to deficient plea colloquy
right.
cases.
Right.
And only that. So,
right.
So unlike maybe other jurisdictions that follow the ABA rule, we have Bangert. We still have Reppin. I hear your argument to be getting away from Bangert. As I quoted earlier, the Brown case, and I think both Kane case, both recent, the rather the well, Kane case, yes, that's a recent one that you cited, affirm Bangert in the sense that they say once you make these two appointed deficiency in the plea colloquy with regard to a mandated element, mandated information, and you assert you didn't know, you must hold the Bangert hearing. Now, in Cross, we backed away a little bit and talked about the word substantial. But our jurisprudence has been that with regard to plea deficiency cases, it's Bangert. It's not the general manifest injustice.
Yeah, but Bangert does nothing more than shift the burden of proof. In Repin, the court said the burden is on the defendant to show a manifest injustice. And then I might also interject in here, I didn't discuss this fully in the brief, but in Ernst, 2 years later, in 1969, this court first made the plea colloquy mandatory following Boykin versus Alabama and Rule 11, the federal rules. But it still retained the burden of proof stated in Repin.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with Repin.
Okay, so up until Bangert, from Ernst until Bangert, what we had was a situation where the plea colloquy was mandatory, but the burden was still on the defendant to prove manifest injustice. Now, what Bangert did, and this is all Bangert did, was to say that in the situation where the mandatory plea colloquy under Ernst is deficient somehow, the defendant's burden is not to show a manifest injustice, but just to show that the plea colloquy was deficient, after which the burden now gets shifted to the state to show that the plea was nevertheless knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. That's Bangert. Now, as you point out, cases that have Bangert and cases that have followed it say that where the defendant makes the requisite allegation that the plea colloquy was deficient in that the judge did not fully explain or did not tell him some of the things that are supposed to be told at a plea colloquy, and the defendant alleges that he didn't know whatever item it was that was not sufficiently explained during the plea colloquy, he gets a hearing. I grant you that.
And didn't that motion in this case make that prima facie showing?
Yes, I grant you that. I'll grant you both of those. I'll grant you both of those points.
And didn't the majority opinion in Brown say if the prima facie showing is made, then you must hold a Bangert hearing?
I'll grant you that.
And didn't Cain also say the same thing?
I'll grant you
but
that.
But you're saying, no, we'll just blend.
But you're not, the point is, you're not looking at other law,
no,
other
the point
well-settled
is this,
jurisprudence.
Counsel, the point is this.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you're merging. You're saying Repin is the law, manifest injustice is the test. I point to the certification as to reflect what the Court of Appeals thinks, rightly or wrongly, that Bangert is, as they say, an exception to the manifest injustice. They
well, I think that's wrong.
Okay. Let's take a look at the bench book and see what the judges on the who write the bench book think, okay? So these judges who do the bench book have, and I'm looking from Criminal 42-5, withdrawal of plea of guilty or no contest after sentence. So they have certain headings. A is the court has an inherent authority to do anything we want. But now, well, I shouldn't say that, to hear motions to permit withdrawal of plea. But now I get to the substance. Then they have a whole section that goes for a couple of pages, withdrawal on grounds of manifest injustice. And then they say, what's manifest injustice under this subheading B? And they give examples. Under that, defendant denied effective assistance of counsel, plea not entered or ratified by defendant, plea was involuntary without knowledge that conduct, and this is the one you're talking about, to which defendant plead guilty does not fall within the charged offenses. D is a defendant did not receive concessions contemplated by the plea agreement, and there's a few more, an E and an F. Then they get to the next heading, which is a big C, the other area for withdrawal of pleas after sentencing is C, withdrawal on grounds of denial of constitutional rights. And they have about a
half page about that. Then they get to the next page, D, withdrawal on grounds of 97108, failure to comply with mandated duties set forth in Bangert. So at least these jury instructions aren't saying, oh, just do the manifest injustice. It's the same thing. It appears several pages later as a discrete procedure that we are to follow. But you want to forget about that procedure.
No, I don't want you to forget about it.
Not employ it in this case, even though a prima facie case was made.
Yeah, I don't want you to forget about it, and I don't want you to forget about the other cases dealing with when you get an evidentiary hearing that say you don't get an evidentiary hearing under two circumstances. One, if your pleadings are insufficient, which is not the situation we have here, but the other situation is if the record conclusively shows that you're not entitled to relief, because there's no reason to have an evidentiary hearing that's going nowhere, where the record already shows that you lose. Why have an evidentiary hearing if you're going to lose?
Why doesn't the record show that you're going to probably lose or likely lose, but you never know what's going to be testified?
Because the record in this case shows it's not probable loss, it's not likely loss, it's clear, absolute loss. In that, you lose, the defendant loses, he cannot show his plea is knowing, is unknowing, involuntary, and unintelligent when he is given a maximum sentence, when he is told a maximum sentence, even if it's wrong, he enters his plea deliberately taking the risk that he's going to get the sentence that the judge tells him can be imposed. And that sentence is imposed. He knows enough. His plea is sufficiently knowing, sufficiently voluntary, and sufficiently intelligent if he knows that the sentence he actually gets could have been imposed on him.
That's what your brief says at the bottom of five, as I read it. And to me, when you make that argument, that he got a sentence that fit with what the judge says was the statutory sentence, that it's harmless error because it couldn't have affected his plea. He thought he was going to get six. He got six. It couldn't have affected his plea. It wouldn't have changed the result. And that's what I read the certification memo as saying, that you got some confusion here in the cases between what is harmless error and how you apply that test in an absolute Bangert violation, which this is on its face. It's an absolute Bangert violation. When do you apply that harmless error test, and when do you say he gets an evidentiary hearing? And what is the relationship to looking at the record as a whole? I think those three things play a role. And the cases are not clear, and I'm not clear in my own mind, when you fit them in.
All right.
Maybe you disagree with my analysis.
I disagree with kind of the first principle of your analysis, which is that the harmless error rule applies.
You don't think it does apply?
I don't think it does.
But
and I'm talking
no
about
error.
The legal harmless error rule. Now, as I point out in my brief, there are certainly situations, factually, where something can be harmless error and not a manifest injustice.
Okay.
The situation where the defendant would have pleaded guilty anyway, even if he would have known the correct maximum. It's not only harmless error under the traditional test for harmless error, but it's not a manifest injustice. It's not unjust to hold a defendant to his plea if he would have pleaded anyway, even if he would have known the correct information. So,
Counselor, isn't there a little bit of a difference in how you approach this in regard to who has the burden of proof? Because under a Bangert error, which I think you agree occurred, then the state has the burden, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And if you're looking at harmless error, again, the state has the burden.
The state does have the burden.
But if you're looking at whether there's been manifest injustice, the defendant has the burden. And some of that becomes problematic just because the way you characterize it.
Well, see, that's the problem when you throw in Bangert. As a general rule, Reppin is still good law in terms of who's got the burden to show manifest injustice. Bangert creates, if you want to call it an exception, it creates an exception to the general rule in Bangert, in Reppin as to who has the burden of proof. It creates an exception for that one situation where the defendant wants to withdraw his plea because the Bangert colloquy was inadequate. In that one situation, the burden of proof established by Reppin does not apply anymore. The defendant has only a minimal burden under those circumstances to show that the Bangert colloquy was defective, after which the burden shifts to the state to show that there was no manifest injustice. So that is an exception to the general burden of proof under the manifest injustice test Reppin and everything else that goes along the line.
All right. So you're saying that applying Bangert here, still the state has the same burden of proof as they would if they were doing harmless error.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Did the state put in any evidence with regard to what the record shows at this evidentiary hearing, at this hearing? In other words,
I don't quite understand your question.
Did the state met any burden here?
There was no evidentiary hearing.
That's right.
They put in no evidence.
Okay, so the state carried no burden here.
Huh? Well, no factual burden. I have to make that clear. It did not carry a factual burden. It carried a legal burden.
So it didn't put into evidence anything. There's no evidence.
Any facts.
Yeah, that's right.
Other than the facts that are already in the record and indisputable because they're in the record.
Does the record indicate that they made reference to those facts at this hearing that wasn't an evidentiary hearing? And did the court consider those facts of record in making its determination at this non-evidentiary hearing?
Well, the court, you're talking about the circuit court here now?
Yeah.
The circuit court made a ruling that there was harmless error here.
That's right.
I think the rubric was wrong. I think the rationale was correct. If you want to call it harmless error, which I think is wrong. If you want to call it no manifest injustice, which I think is correct, what the trial court's ruling was that since he got the 6 years he was told he could get, there's no problem.
That's right.
Whether it's harmless error or manifest injustice, no problem.
It had nothing to do with whether or not the plea was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, which was the basis of the motion.
By saying that he got the sentence he was told and knew he could get, the court was, in effect, saying that his plea was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent.
We point to the complaint, and we point to in our discussion here today the plea advisement, but that wasn't the subject of this hearing.
None of that was ever brought up.
Back to the question I posed to you, which was not answered through no fault of yours, the relationship of manifest injustice, Bangert, and harmless error. They meld.
I don't think they can meld factually. I don't think they meld legally. These are harmless error and lack of manifest injustice are two distinct legal concepts. But there can certainly be, as I was indicating before, there certainly can be factual situations in which an error can be both harmless under the harmless error test and no manifest injustice under the manifest injustice test. So factually, yes, they can meld in that sense.
And you say, as a matter of law, using the ABA standards,
right,
when a defendant is told the wrong penalty, and that wrong penalty is less than the actual statutory penalty, and the defendant is then given no more than the penalty told, that's the 6 years here, that as a matter of law,
this plea is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent.
It is not manifest injustice.
There's no manifest injustice.
And manifest injustice there means, and it has several different components that might prove manifest injustice, as a matter of law, it is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntary.
That's correct.
That is your view of, as a matter of law, on Rippon.
That's my position, yeah.
That's your position. Right. It is knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily given.
Not you because he knows need, everything.
That's right. You don't need an evidentiary hearing. That this concept overrides the statute, which requires that you be told what the penalty is, and overrides Bankert, which says you have to be told what the penalty is. You don't like my saying overrides.
No, let me make clear. It doesn't override those. Right. I mean, the statute is still there.
Right.
Bangert is still there.
You just don't apply it here.
We do apply it, but we say that there was error. There was a statutory error. The judge didn't do what the statute says. There was a Bangert error because the judge didn't do what Bangert says. But it wasn't manifestly unjust to hold this defendant to his plea because he got what he knew he could get.
And that was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent.
And was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent.
That's it. And you never get to harmless error because even though there's error, you
right.
say it's not falling within
right.
manifest
yeah.
injustice. That's how
we
you keep the whole thing together.
We don't ignore errors. I'm trying to phrase this. Harmless error is not the only situation in which we can ignore errors. Manifest injustice is another situation in which we can ignore errors.
Or knowing intelligent and voluntary is
right.
another situation where you can ignore the
right.
error.
Right.
It's sort of the same thing as saying, look at the record. But here you would look at this concept that he knew. Okay.
Right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Mr. Hingle, I'm sorry.
I'd just like to address a couple of things. First, with respect to Rippon and the mystery of how it and Bangert coexist, I think that this court actually elucidated that a little bit in the recent case of State v. Kane. In that case, the issue was that the defendant had pled, and it had been a proper colloquy, he pled to possession of a certain number of marijuana plants. The statute requires you to possess 5 in order to be convicted at this certain penalty level. And even though he admitted to everything and the judge told him everything he was supposed to tell him, one thing that he wouldn't agree with was he said, well, I had 4. He maintained that quite vociferously throughout the plea colloquy. And this court pointed out, and this court analyzed Kane under, I guess, what we can call the Rippon test or the ABA test. And it said repeatedly, you know, pointed out repeatedly that this is not a Bangert case, and that's why it was under Rippon. And if you look to the elements that are listed under Rippon or the examples that are listed under Rippon, the vast majority of them have absolutely nothing to do with the plea colloquy. You have basically an ineffective assistance of counsel issue, and then you have the last three out of the 6 are sort of variants of plea breach, some of which don't apply in Wisconsin.
What do you think the phrase manifest injustice means?
Well, I suppose the phrase manifest injustice, I mean, as a dictionary matter, means injustice that's clear. In the legal situation, I think that in the plea withdrawal context, it means that the defendant shows that there's something unfair about holding them to the plea that they have given.
I'm looking at the Wisconsin Criminal Practice and Procedure Manual, where the person shows either that the plea was involuntary, was entered without knowledge of the charge, or was entered without knowledge that the sentence actually imposed could be imposed. Now, the footnote cite is to Cross, and that's one interpretation. Why is that not the correct interpretation? That the sentence, that the plea was entered without knowledge that the sentence actually imposed could be imposed?
Well, I think that's a very clear example of manifest injustice. I don't think that, but I think what it is an example, and that's exactly.
If the defendant knows that the defendant could be sentenced up to 6 years and is sentenced to 6 years.
That's not what that says. That says that the converse would be a manifest injustice. It doesn't say that this is the only case in which misadvice about sentencing can be a manifest injustice. And that language, of course, comes directly from the ABA standards, which Repin and various other cases have been very careful to point out, are examples, and examples of which there are more. I just finished my point about Repin by pointing out that while it is occasionally cited, it's very seldom cited in Bangert cases, and often when it is cited, that list of examples is not mentioned at all, or when it's mentioned, that third point that Justice Gableman made is actually truncated, as it was in Kane. It just says plea was involuntary and doesn't make any reference to whether the sentence actually whether the defendant knew that the sentence.
You said that the plea was involuntary?
Pardon?
Did you just say that?
I think what you read says the plea was involuntary or entered without or blah, blah, blah. And what I'm saying is that in Kane and in a few other cases, when this court has cited that example, it's just left it at involuntary. It seems to me that that language has sort of fallen into disuse, probably because we have Bangert.
Is the defendant in this case making any assertion that the sentence actually imposed could not have been imposed? In other words, the language that was just read is, under manifest injustice, plea was involuntary without knowledge that conduct to which the defendant pleaded does not fall within charged offense, that has nothing to do with this, or that sentence actually imposed could be imposed. I don't understand that the defendant is asserting that 6 years isn't the kind of sentence that could be imposed here. He's asserting that his plea was not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Well, that's
he's
correct.
Asserting the Bangert violation.
That's correct.
And
that's
not
correct.
That the sentence actually imposed could not be imposed.
That's correct. And what I was attempting to explain is how, Bangert, I guess, is a separate category of plea withdrawal cases. I can see that my time has expired, so unless there are any other
questions. Yeah, the questions are coming. Your time has expired then. Thank you, Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Balistrari. For yet another case arising under Bangert, let alone another case arising under harmless error. But we haven't heard about Repin for a long time, so that adds a new wrinkle. And we appreciate your briefs and your oral argument. And that concludes the hearing in 11AP 1030 CR State versus Gerald D. Taylor. If the students from Grover University will remain here, the justice will be out and discuss the procedures of the court. Everyone is welcome to stay with this class to discuss or hear a discussion of procedures of the court. The substantive issues of the case will not be discussed. We are in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case.